Broadcasting from the beautiful Hill Country in Texas, this is OneRadioNetwork.com.
We talk about your health, wealth, and well-being on OneRadioNetwork.com. Once again, here's Patrick.
And Andrew Goss, a currency historian, two books, Secret World of Money. Uncle Sam cooks the books. And if you'd like to be on the show, do it. 888-663-6386. Email Patrick at OneRadioNetwork.com. This is a hilarious story. You got to love this one from Reuters. Vladimir Putin says this morning he can prove that Trump did not pass Russian secrets during that meeting, and he's welcome. He'll give him his transcript if the people want it. Yeah. The Dems are going to have fun with that.
Oh my God!
You just can't make this up, isn't it? You know, I think it's fun.
Well, no, but you can draw inferences, and that's what we were just discussing with Gates and Ted Turner and Mark Zuckerberg. You know, that's all pure conjecture. It's what the lawyers call circumstantial evidence.
It's all hearsay.
It's all circumstantial evidence. Yeah, you look at the circumstances and you say, okay, was that an accident? It doesn't seem like it was. So it is pure, however, speculation on my part and my opinion.
Right, that's right. Everything here is in your opinion, right?
Most of it. Pretty much. Some of it, like, well, you know, when I talk about
like
Senate
the H-401 report.
Yeah, or the Senate report 93-549. Now, I've been bringing that up a lot lately because folks want to know how we got here from there. And I urge them to read that Senate report, which I've talked about on this show many times. The Senate report 93-549.
I'm going to write that down. I want to look at it.
Yeah,
so it's
93-549.
Senate report.
Yeah.
Okay. And when was that?
Oh, gosh. When was that? 70s? 60s?
Okay.
70s? 70s.
And what did this little report say?
Well, it just proved that in the period from 1913 to 1934, the Federal Reserve caused the corporate bankruptcy of the United States. It's pretty powerful stuff. You know,
it caused corporate bankruptcy. What do you mean here? Talk to us like we're a golden retriever. Tell us what that is.
Well, so we gave the power to coin money effectively, right, to the Federal Reserve. And their task was not to issue more notes than there was gold and silver in the vaults.
1913.
That's correct.
That was the deal.
Was that the deal
in the bill that Wilson signed?
No.
Oh.
Not
this was
not
like,
exactly.
Like under the table talk?
No, it was when you boiled it down and read all of the regulations.
Okay.
This was the net effect.
Well, that's what I asked.
So
it was in the bill.
It's all in the language of the bill,
okay.
What they were allowed to do and were not allowed to do.
No more dollars than 35 than bucks
that's
worth of
right.
gold. Okay.
That's right.
Well, that
so
sounds
you,
good.
You set the standard, which was $20.
Oh,
for every 20? Ounce of $20 for every ounce.
So
of gold.
This is not a terrible conspiracy. This was a good thing.
And right.
I mean, okay, I'm with
and
you.
To give us a uniform currency throughout the United States.
I vote for that.
Well, sure. We all get to use the same money.
Even though nobody was in town when they voted for it, but that's another story.
Yeah. What the quorum was is another story.
It was Christmas Eve, but no.
Yeah,
okay, we'll let that go for a moment.
So we get this legislation in that gives the Federal Reserve the power to do this.
Yes, I like
and,
it.
Right, and so that Senate report, 93-549, you know, we have been under a state of emergency ever since the Federal Reserve did this.
Did what?
Issued more notes than they had gold and silver coins in the vault.
Yeah, but you wouldn't know when exactly they did it.
You know that by 1934, we had suspended specie payment. The President Roosevelt closed all the banks and said,
okay,
the banks are all closed now, and no one can go into the bank and ask for their gold.
Was that like on TV? Well, they didn't have TV. Was that like on radio and a major
deal? It was
a
fireside chat.
Fireside chat.
Mm-hmm.
You can't go in and get your gold anymore.
Can't go in and get your gold.
What was your reaction to that? Do we know?
Well, he was very good at making it sound like your patriotic duty to turn your gold over.
We'll have to look at some.
We're going to take all the gold.
Okay.
We're going to put it in Fort Knox.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to watch it like a hawk.
Mm-hmm.
And then we know that it, you know, It's in one place. Mm-hmm. You can't get it, but at least you know it's there.
And the check's in the mail. Yeah.
And here's your check. Mm-hmm. And just use the check as though it were money. Well, so in 1975, the Senate Select Committee on Assassinations, you remember all that. It was 76, 77, mm-hmm. when they said, well, what is this deal? Like, we've been in a national emergency forever.
Oh, you mean so, excuse me, so in 1934.
Yeah, we declared a national emergency.
Who did?
Roosevelt.
A national emergency.
That's right.
Well, I mean, that's just some kind of piece of paper saying, you know, all hands on deck. It's not a big deal.
Well, nonsense. What it says is we're transferring the powers that Congress normally has to the president.
Really?
Yeah. That's where these EOs come from.
So that we're still in a national emergency today?
And have been.
Since 1934?
Ever since 1930. Right.
Oh, well, that's curious.
So this Senate report, Congress, it's a special committee to terminate the national emergency. So they did this big study,
yeah,
and then recognized that we can't cancel the national emergency.
Why?
Because our entire monetary system is based upon it.
No, you just said that the president could do EOs, but
that's correct.
But what's it got to do with the monetary system?
Because the Constitution says no state shall make anything but gold and silver coin a tender payment of debt.
Color me. So, okay, so this is how they got around the whole Article 1, Section 8 by declaring a national emergency.
That's right.
Oh,
and in 71, Nixon made a declaration about floating the dollar, closing of the gold window, et cetera, right?
Yes.
Well, couldn't have done it without having a declared emergency. Couldn't have done it.
It was already on the, baked in the cake.
Yeah, same with the postal strike, same with the Korean War, the Trading with the Enemy Act, so that we could stop gold and silver transactions.
So this is why President Trump could call in the Marines and go into the Bank of Dripping Springs and, I don't know, break it down and say, you guys are bad or something. Because we're under a national emergency. They can do whatever they want.
Well, that's what Nixon did, if you recall, during that postal strike in 1970. So the mailmen, the postal people go on an 8-day strike.
Yeah.
I guess it was in March of 1970.
Yeah.
And started in New York City, right here. Yeah. Well, goodness, you know, that was a wildcat strike like never before. The post office on strike. And so Nixon called out the National Guard.
Good for him.
Yeah. Broke the strike.
Go, Dick.
And then, of course, Reagan used it again on PATCO with the professional air traffic controllers.
And so the only reason they can do that, not because they're president.
Correct.
But because
we're in a state of emergency.
The United States is in a state of emergency.
And has been since 1933. Yeah, 33-4, end of 33, beginning of 33.
And Wilson did that.
No, Roosevelt.
Roosevelt. And his reasoning was?
Well, he needed the executive power to do all this stuff. You know, that was what he...
But what was the reasoning for a national... Oh, because of the whole...
This is an emergency, man.
We don't have enough gold. We have no...
Yeah. I have time to come to you and ask your permission to do things. I need to do it without your... So, effectively, this national emergency broadened executive power. It took power away from the Congress and gave it to the president. So, as long as we're under this state of national emergency, then things that would otherwise not be okay are suddenly okay. And so the Senate in 1976 was like, okay, by now
we can get
off this emergency, right? So they launched this big investigation and issued this Senate report.
Yeah, which is Senate Report 93-549.
Correct.
I'm going to read that sucker.
Well, good luck with that, what? Man. Oh, well, reading it, it's...
It's just not.
No.
You got the cliff notes.
Yeah, well, yeah.
That's what you need, right?
Yeah.
All right, so let me see if I found the bouncing ball here. So Nixon, Kennedy, whoever started it, you can go into places like Vietnam without Congress declaring war or Iraq and all that?
Truman, 1950.
Korean War.
Conflict.
Yeah, conflict. Or the Vietnam was a...
Police action.
Police action. Tell that to the 55,000
guys that died. Yeah,
and, or 500,000 are wounded.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So that's how they get away with this now.
National emergency.
Mm-hmm. Well, then President Trump should be able to give away secrets and stuff. I mean, you know, if you're going to... I'm just kidding. No. No. So these EOs, that's why executive orders even fly.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. Well, the National Emergencies Act was the result of this investigation by the Senate. And essentially, they understood from the report that we needed this.
We had
and
to
that
keep
these,
it.
Yeah. And that these open-ended states of national emergency were sometimes required, even though the legislation was intended to stop them. These open-ended national emergencies, that's what we're operating under today.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to be more more specific and more concise. But certainly, as it relates to the closing of the gold window and the suspension of specie payment, this is essentially what's happened. Because the Constitution still says, right, no state shall make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debt. And that Congress shall have the power to coin money and regulate the value thereof.
Mm-hmm.
Well, without an emergency situation, this would be the supreme law of the land. That's what the Constitution is. And absent a state of emergency, you could go to the Supreme Court or even to a federal district court and say, hey, wait a minute, this Federal Reserve note is not gold and silver coin, so it's not money. But because we're in a state of emergency, you can't even do that.
So that's where a lot of the patriot folks who talk about this stuff on the interweb and stuff over the years, they miss these kinds of fine points.
Well, the courts sure don't miss them.
Yeah, the courts
when
don't.
They bring their cases in, you know.
Sure, because
the states just take the judges and the courts take silent judicial notice, so they know in their minds that your point it would be valid
if
we weren't under a national state of emergency.
If you weren't sitting on the plastic.
That's,
so to speak.
That's
so
right.
It's the same thing, I guess, with the income tax, where in 1942, they passed an income tax for the war, and it's going to be a two-year deal, and oops, we've never repealed that.
That's right.
Kind of thing.
And then, of course, the declaration of a national emergency. So we've had, I don't know, I think 30 national emergencies declared since they passed the National Emergency Act in 1976. So they've passed... they passed the act in 1976 that says you can't have these open-ended states of emergency. And so then 30 how many years between 76 and 01? It's like every president in every term signed a national emergency declaration.
Oh,
every,
I see.
So.
It's kind of the stuff he does when he's drinking coffee here, sign this.
Yeah, well, one of them.
Yeah.
And so what we've been in, as a result, we've been... in a state of national emergency since 1933, and as a result, the provisions of the Constitution that we so greatly rely on
doesn't really count.
Are inoperative.
It
yeah,
that's how
like
we got
suspending,
on the plastic, right?
Yes, yeah. Like suspending the debt ceiling.
Yeah. So, but back in when the Federal Reserve Act went into place, and they were supposed to have enough gold for every dollar, $20 at. A dollar, right? $20 an ounce. Excuse me, $20 an ounce. Who figured out that they were cooking the books over these 20 years? Who went in there and dug into that?
I'm sorry, I'm not following you.
In other words, how did Roosevelt even know that the Fed didn't have enough gold and all of that stuff?
Because they told him. Huh? You know, I've done
if they're
that.
Private banks, why would they tell him?
Well, the Federal Reserve told him, not the banks that own
the
Federal Reserve.
The Federal Reserve Board.
The
said,
Federal
listen,
Reserve
these dudes,
chairman of the Fed said, yeah.
They've been the cooking the books ever since 1913.
Yeah.
Whoops.
This is what we did. And I talked about the most prominent one that was known about then but not prosecuted was a gentleman named Eugene Meyer. Eugene Meyer.
Yeah.
The father of a woman named Catherine Graham.
Washington Post.
Eugene Meyer issued duplicate bonds and engaged in a duplicate bond scheme where he would pledge bonds that were fake in exchange for huge loans on margin. And being closely connected with the money power, his actions were never prosecuted, though they were severely proven. And again, he was just kind of let off the hook. But this was one of the examples that showed Roosevelt that there were more notes for money than there was money.
Uh-huh.
Now, he could have put everybody in jail. He could have, you know, I'm gathering up all the Federal Reserve guys and I'm putting them in jail for fraud. But instead, he legalized their theft by saying, if you have gold, you have to turn it over to the Treasury. Not to the Treasury. You have to turn it over to the Federal Reserve banks. If you read the executive order,
wow,
that's who you were giving your gold to, not to the Treasury, but to the Federal Reserve banks. And then they, in return, would give you back Federal Reserve notes. and that's how we operated from 34 until 63.
Till 63, till Nixon did the deal.
No, till Kennedy did the deal.
Kennedy.
Kennedy issued U.S. notes to compete. Ike did, too, to build the interstate system. But Kennedy did the big chunk. I think his was $300 million.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted it max, most that we could issue. And all of the silver in the Treasury that isn't committed, mm-hmm. I want that made into silver certificates, and I don't want to borrow any more money from the Federal Reserve.
Whoa. Poking the giant in the eye, right?
Yeah.
Really doing it.
Of course, with his death, we went back to business as usual.
Mm-hmm.
No more U.S. notes. No more silver certificates, by the way, right? In 67, that was Johnson's first act was... Kennedy had ordered silver dollars struck again in 1964, the famed 64 peace dollar. So first act, Johnson canceled that idea. So we got no new silver dollars in 64. And he withdrew all of the silver certificates from circulation. He said, if you have a silver certificate, you have to cash it by 1967. After that, it's no good anymore. It's just a dollar. So the plans were already in place, no doubt in my mind, when Johnson took over.
Oh, it feels like it. Well, it is May 17, 2017. You have no idea where I have no idea where we're going. I get all these tabs, and we get down to places like this and learn so much. It's like, man, it's just so amazing how this thing has gone on the way. I want to get into this a little bit, and I don't know where I'm going with this, but this just seems too interesting, Andrew, not to talk about it. Okay, so there's an organization called GIGA Group, which is a gold refining, one of the big ones, right? One of the big gold refiners established, blah, blah, blah. And so
that's that Indian operation.
Yeah, that's right. So Jim Sinclair, as you know, a little background on him, but he's writing this organization. He says... In the period of 1968 to March 1980, it was rumored, writes Jim Sinclair, that I was the largest volume gold trader in the world. If there was some larger, I'd never met him. In 1980, the Wall Street Journal ran the article, Bull Takes Off His Horns, which I hold as a reminder of that period. The statement that GG, which is his company, points out in the opening note to me, finds its roots in the school of free gold. This group of thinkers is absolutely correct on its main subject, gold itself. Like any other group, there are offshoots that hold various views that can cloud the main text. He said, in my opinion, the foundation is the only correct answer to what gold is, how gold functions in the economic system, why the paper gold market was started, by whom it was started, and for what purpose the paper gold market actually exists. The school of thought goes on to predict that the future of gold's value is not as an alternative currency for the exchange of goods and services, but it's a storehouse of value for holders, both public and private. Okay? Are we okay so far?
I am. No qualms with anything.
In March of 80, which was the end of the 1968 gold bull market, a client of one of my firms, I'm going to skip this one. I told him, this client in 80, I anticipated a bear market in gold of no less than 15 years, and that I was in the process of selling all my firms and then I would walk out the same door that I told him to go out. Wow. So back then, he was right, right?
Of course.
Of course.
Because of the paper gold market.
That's right. So he said the next fortune in gold will be made via long physical gold margin free in an enormous way. Due to the volatility of the price of gold, there can be no margin involved nor paper gold derivatives.
Mm-hmm.
The formula is simply to expound but very hard to exercise. It's called full utilization of our capital individuality to identify a huge deposit of gold relatively inexpensive to mine. Let's see, what I proposed was a public mining company, blah, 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 blah. So.
A public mining company.
Right. So this is what.
Based domestically.
That's right. This is what he started, right?
But they took Sinclair's idea and it became American Barrick.
Right. That's what he's talking about here.
Yeah.
He said, let's see.
But that's not the People's Mining Company. So they essentially did what he advocated, only they used a private company to do it.
So he's saying here, our dollar has already been hyperinflated, but without the higher price effects.
That's right, because of paper gold.
Years of deficit spending over borrowing debt expansion have created an illusion that the dollar was immune to price inflation.
Correct, because we've hidden the inflation in the trust funds.
Yes, this illusion is evident in our massive trade deficit as it carries it on with no negative effects on dollar exchange rates.
That's right.
Clearly, other investors outside the central bank were helping the dollar support process without knowing they were buying into a dying currency system.
Correct.
The only thing that kept this process from showing up in the prices of everyday goods was the support other central banks showed for our currency through exchange intervention.
That's right.
That's right. So as I pointed out in my other writings, this support was involved at best and done over 15 to 20 years. Still, it's been done with the purpose all this time. That purpose was to maintain the dollar work and economic value, right?
That's correct.
The entire long-term process was clear to a few major financial players as they prepared for the dollar's retirement as a reserve. Their main strategy for dealing with this was found in several positions. One was a long-term buying of real physical gold.
Yes.
Better said, the process of dollar contract failure would show up in the form of discounts on these derivatives from par value because most of the end-time dollar world has built itself into a huge derivative game. This discounting will occur across the board in almost everything we deal with, not just cold. So what's he saying here?
Well, the which do you want? Do you want? And I'll tell you, the same was true in 1980. It was, and I remember IGBE was doing this exact thing. You want physical gold for delivery today? That's $800 an ounce.
Mm-hmm.
You want physical gold for delivery in 2 weeks? $770. You'll take physical gold, but you won't take delivery at all? $720. So the discounts for paper positions over spot, or
right,
give me the gold, physical gold, started to show up and did for quite a period.
He goes on that it's only in the last year that we can see where equity markets are telegraphing a transition into dollar expansion without world support.
Yes.
What does that mean?
Well, the people that know have been buying the stocks in the anticipation that the equities,
yeah,
will inflate along with the inflated dollar.
Okay. So better said, major price inflation is coming on a level equal to hyper status. Many stock markets have already headed straight up in that reflection of this.
Correct, yes, because the equities, obviously, unlike the bonds, tend to increase when there's an increase in the money supply.
See, you're so smart. That's why I'm reading this. Another area where we see the changes in oil.
Again, physical possession.
Yeah, once the euro was born and seen in operation as a possible backup currency, added crude supply to keep prices low was no longer available. Prices have risen and fallen in a broken fashion that will continue its upward bias. Whatever that,
yeah,
means.
So while it might go up and down, its, yeah, general trend is up.
Its general trend is up. Okay, let's see. This, let's see, down, 60 physical gold outside. Blah, blah, blah. The most recent example of official policy change towards the dollar was found in the Washington Agreement. It marks the end of the Euroland support for the paper gold markets that helped maintain Dollar Oil Settlements Board. This is beginning in the 80s. Joint effort by the last two factions that has today become the only single effort by one faction, U.S. Britain. What's he saying there?
U.S. and Britain cooperate.
Well, okay. For years, gold bugs have figured that gold would be the next dollar escape mechanism, not another currency.
Right.
This gave little thought to the reality that our modern world could not, would not price gold as a reserve-free trading asset without a digital paper money reserve to do it. Once the dollar begins its decline through the price inflation, its use as a reserve and, more importantly, its use to establish gold markets will stop. You think that's true?
No, not for the moment, but eventually, yes.
So what's he saying here?
Well, he's saying that the dollar as a means to measure gold's value. Right now, the London fix, right? Dollars are fixed. Excuse me, gold is fixed in dollars throughout the world. How many dollars to the ounce? So whatever your currency is, you have to convert it, then get the gold in dollars. Same with oil, incidentally, priced in dollars. Once that status is lost, then the ability to affect the price is also lost.
He said, we may see dollar price inflation in all things, yet gold falls as contracts fall from constricted supply.
Correct.
Eventually, even the mining sector will be forced from shareholder losses and poor contract price economics to abandon the dollar pricing contract system.
Correct.
Wow. What's that mean?
Well, what I just said. Yeah. As they lose confidence in the dollar, then pricing gold in dollars also disappears.
So I expect that during this time, the physical price of gold will be soaring as its lack of trade constricts supply. Most paper gold traders today don't understand how a real dollar price inflation shrinks physical gold trade, no matter how high or low the price goes.
That's right.
That's pretty interesting.
Yes.
Wow.
There is a fixed supply.
Yeah.
And that's what I bet on with the numismatic coins.
Mm-hmm.
They can't dig more of those out of the ground.
So he also contends that there's going to be a time here when the miners, they're not going to even be selling their gold. They're just going to mine it and keep it.
Yeah.
Because it's money.
Already you have the hedged versus unhedged. So the number of hedged mines where they sell their production in advance. So regardless of if the price of gold or the price of the dollar fluctuates, the price that they get for the metal they dig out of the ground is constant. And in that way, they can figure their costs and so forth. So the unhedged mines might not sell it at all, but instead maybe even keep it in their own vaults or borrow against it.
Mm-hmm.
So this, of course, reduces the amount of gold available on the market and exacerbates the problem. That's why I've urged people, if you're going to buy mining shares, at least buy unhedged mining shares that might benefit.
Yeah. I think Sinclair has a mining share. What's the name of it? TRX, I think. I think it's TRX. Jim Sinclair thing. He's a pretty cool guy. He's been around
the
bend.
Cool guy,
he's been around the bend, hasn't he?
God, I remember him from a national conference on monetary reform, which was, dating myself here, 1981. He was prominent. So here you are this long later. He's only gotten more so.
Yeah. Well, I
and,
guess
you know, he probably forgot more about gold than I know.
And then he's a silver guy too, right? There's a
I would say he is a silver bug over gold.
More silver, yeah. Yeah, I got a few shares of it. It's TRX. Scott the Trader would help me find. Oh, I knew that one, TRX. 53 cents a share. It's up $77 this morning. I made $77 this morning. Think I should sell? Just kidding. Okay, 888-663-6386. Email Patrick at oneradionetwork.com. So knowing all that you know to our listeners around the world, so what's the big advantage of, if people start to understand a lot of this stuff with gold, of doing like a numismatic stuff rather than a Krugerrand stuff?
All right, well, let's start with the executive order that made it illegal to own gold.
Hmm.
So that executive order said that if you're in possession of gold, you must sell it to the Federal Reserve in exchange for Federal Reserve notes.
1933, right?
What's exempted? 5 ounces for personal use and coins of unusual collector value.
Oh, they must have had a coin collection there. Wrote that.
Yeah. So to begin with, it was exempt from confiscation, mm-hmm. if you want to call it that. But they didn't exactly confiscate your gold. They gave you Federal Reserve notes. They just forced you to sell it to this buyer, the Federal Reserve banks. And so that's number one. Number two, the tendency is whenever the price of gold rises, that mines increase production. They increase capacity. They increase the amount of gold that's coming on the market. And so demand increases, supply increases, and they kind of offset each other. Without the supply increase, the price increase is much greater. If the supply remains the same and only demand increases, then the price rises a lot faster than it does when both are increasing, when both supply and demand are going up.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of numismatic coins, especially the ones struck before the Civil War, in the Age of Jackson, and before, because they've already been through 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 depressions, deflationary depressions, where the coins were used to their fullest extent, or they were melted to retrieve the extra gold and silver, and so the remaining supplies are a mere fraction of the original mintage. Then you narrow it even further by buying only coins that haven't been cleaned, altered, messed with in any way. They're completely original. Now that supply universe becomes even smaller, and if you focus entirely upon mintage, to begin with.
We love that word.
Oh, yes.
If you get a
coin that was struck before the Civil War and has a mintage of less than 100, maybe 10, maybe 15 exist. And so that type of fixed supply against increasing demand, both in terms of total Federal Reserve notes and in terms of people willing to take those Federal Reserve notes and exchange them for these rare coins, boy, now you just have a supply and demand equation that's a perfect storm. Fixed supply, increasing demand, exempt from confiscation, also exempt from reportability. You know, coins are treated as personal property, not investments. There's no 1099s. There's no social security numbers when you sell them and all that sort of thing. So they
and
just have all the advantages.
Is it pretty easy to pass these on to the kids without a lot of...
Same way you would pass on your couch, you know.
So you have a coin that's worth $200,000 and it just like goes in a box and say, this is George's?
Yeah, this George. I leave to my son George my coin collection.
And that's all.
My couch.
And there's
and
no
my
taxes
pet.
On until George sells it.
That's correct.
Wow. That's
and it's not counted in the value of the estate for probate purposes.
How come?
Because it's personal property. What are we going to start counting the forks now? It's personal property, so that's personal property. How much real estate do you have? If you have $600,000...
So they don't count it as money in the bank?
Not at all.
Yeah. That is so curious.
You could say a coin collection with a face value of $200.
Oh, because it's a $20 gold piece.
Well, yeah.
And it's anybody's guess of what it's worth.
What it's really worth. I know I wouldn't sell it for anything. It's priceless to me.
And that's legal.
Well, yeah, it's...
Wow.
It's legal tender. It's money. If you wanted to take a very rare $3 gold piece, you could go down to your bank and you could say, I have this $3 gold piece. I want to deposit it in my checking account.
I don't recommend that.
They could take the $3 gold piece right in your checking account, $3. Patrick just deposited $3.
But what if the gold, what if that's worth?
Wait. Okay. Let's conduct the same exercise using a Krugerrand or a quarter ounce of gold.
Okay.
And you stroll into the bank. I have this quarter ounce of gold. I would like to deposit it in my checking account.
Yeah.
You can't. You have to first sell that quarter ounce of gold and then take the money that you get from it and deposit that in your checking account. And it's a fine point, semantic as it might be. Mm-hmm. The reality is that $3 gold coin is legal tender. It's lawful money. You can deposit it in a checking account. You cannot do that with just an ounce of gold or an ounce of silver.
But what if the $3 gold piece is worth $100,000? You could just tell the teller, this is worth $100,000.
No.
They'll say, we don't buy and sell gold coins.
So. That's right, yeah. At law, however, you are entitled to enter it into the banking system at $3. As you point out, it would be inadvisable to do so. And I'm reminded
probably
of the...
get lost in there somewhere.
There was a 1980s movie called Brewster's Millions, and it was Richard Pryor and John Candy, and the theme of the movie was he had to spend $30 million in 30 days.
Yeah.
And so he went and got a upside-down Jenny, a very famous postage stamp that was worth $1 million because it was printed upside down, and he stuck it on a letter and mailed it. Okay?
Yeah.
Now... the Postal Service had to accept that stamp, and they had to cancel it. They had to mail the letter. At law, he was 100% on the money. So the same would be true if he would have gone and bought a rare silver dollar and then spent it as a... the rarest silver dollar just sold for over $10 million, by the way.
Really?
Yes. So if he would have bought that silver dollar... and one-third of his job would have been done. He'd go down to the candy store, buy himself a dollar's worth of stuff, and then that would have been the end of $10 million. So,
anyway. Heard on the radio yesterday that Garcia guy, the deadhead, what's his face, and Jerry Garcia, they're auctioning off his guitar and he's for charity. I think it's going to take about $2 million to buy it.
Yeah, it's going to bring tangibles. Again.
Tangibles, like even I saw Picasso... some guy just paid $50 million. Could you imagine $50 million for a painting?
Yes.
Just because it's the only one?
Yes.
I mean, it's like
that's
okay.
Right. Okay. When I talk to people and I, you know, a top end. So you take a top end, the rarest, one of the greatest rarest coins ever, and you know it's one of two or one of three, one being in a museum, and maybe there's another one in private hands. Still, you're only talking about a coin that's, I hate to say it so cavalierly, a few hundred thousand dollars.
A few hundred
thousand. A few hundred thousand. When you compare it to something like a Picasso at $50 million, you have to ask yourself, how could they be this dramatically undervalued? And they are. So I would argue that the rarest of the rare American gold coins are a screaming value.
Screaming.
Same, oh, my goodness.
Are they screaming? Like,
they're screaming. I'm cheap. And it's hard to think of something cheap. That's $300,000.
How about us silly rabbits in the audience that you know, we're just getting by and we got a little extra money every now and then, every month, and we have a little bit. Can we get involved in this without, because we don't have a bunch of bucks.
Well,
You know what I mean? Because we're just silly rabbits.
You can. There are coins now. You go up to the next level, you know, one of 1,000 or one of 10,000 and so forth. And the more common it is, the lower the price is.
And you can save up and buy a $1,000 coin.
That's right. There are some of those that represent extraordinary value. You could do the same thing all the way down to the lowly silver dollar, where you can buy an average uncirculated silver dollar for $50.
That's kind of fun.
Or, and that's the semi-numismatic, and that's even numismatic, because the silver content is only about $15, right? So you're paying a premium above and beyond the silver content. And then you can boil it down to the lowest common denominator, which is you bet upon the gold and silver contained in the coin. And when you can buy those numismatic or legal tender, let's call them that, legal tender coins struck by the mint, intended for use as money, for just a fraction over their gold or silver content, now you're betting that the value of gold and silver is going to go up. When you're laying down a few hundred thousand dollars or $50,000 or $10,000 for a single coin that might have a hundredth of that in gold or silver, you're betting on the numismatic value of the coin increasing. So it is two entirely different fields. The gold and silver increase did not affect the numismatic coins. When gold went from 1,000 to 1,900, the impact on numismatic coins was negligible. And I caught a lot of heat from clients that would call and say, what do you mean my numismatic coin has only gone up 3%? Gold has doubled. Okay. But we don't have any of the attendant risks with gold. And then when gold plummeted from 1900 back to 1200, and their numismatic coin not only stayed the same, but might have gone up a couple more percent, now the clarity of owning numismatic coins starts to make sense.
And what's your phone number up there? And folks can talk to you. They like.
Oh, that was a commercial.
That was a commercial,
okay.
I guess.
All right,
I don't know. Who cares?
I buy and sell gold coins in case you're wondering what I do, why I talk like this. That's what I do.
That's
I buy and sell gold coins and silver coins for a living. If you'd like to learn more, mention One Radio Network and call us at 800-468-2646. No one's forcing you to store your wealth in Federal Reserve notes. You have alternatives. You want to buy a Picasso, go ahead. But if you have the money for a Picasso, you should definitely look at U.S. coins.
Well, I tell you, I as you know, I like to flip around the radio when I'm driving in Austin, pick up Houston stations, Dallas, Austin. You know, I just like to hear what people are talking about, and it's kind of fun. And boy, there are lots of commercials of people selling gold. Whoa. But they're all, most of them are all the Krugerrands and stuff like that, right? I guess
Eagles, yeah.
Eagles.
Physical bullion. You know what I consider the bottom of the barrel? Because you only have one way to profit there when you make that bet. And that is you're gambling that the price of gold and silver are going to rise. And it's a pretty safe bet. But when you buy a numismatic coin, you're not gambling that the price of gold and silver are going to rise. You're gambling that the fixed supply and increasing demand for these coins is what's going to drive its price, regardless.
But if somebody had $10,000 and they had it in the bank and they just don't have any need for it, and rather than just letting it sit there, even if they wouldn't buy numismatics, which, you know, your preference, obviously, they'd still be better off having $10,000 worth of Krugerrands rather than Federal Reserve notes, wouldn't
they? Bet, yeah.
Just until sit in the basement, whatever.
Yeah, until the government decides that it's illegal to own that.
Well, I hate it when that happens.
Well, that's a possibility. It's happened before. It's remote, but it's still a possibility. But I would say, why would you do that when you can buy an old $20 gold piece in used condition for also a similar price to the Krugerrand? Why wouldn't you want to just hold a U.S. coin? You're in the United States. If you're in South Africa, okay, you buy the Krugerrand. But you're in the United States, buy an American coin. You can buy those for the same kind of premiums that the Krugerrand has.
Might as well do that, right? Because you're on so much more solid ground.
I think so.
For all the reasons you've talked about.
I think so.
You know, yeah, real American money. Cool.
Yeah, so Ronald Reagan gave us those quarter-ounce $5 gold pieces and $10 gold pieces for the Olympics and the Statue of Liberty and the Constitution. And then prior to that, we, of course, had $20 gold pieces that were heavily circulated and used as money and may have lost the majority of their collector value, but there's still an ounce of gold. And so you can buy those, for a very small fraction, a similar fraction, as a Krugerrand. So you're not paying a huge numismatic premium. If you really just want to own gold, you have a semi-numismatic coin that you can do that with. Mm-hmm.
Andrew Goss, his number up there is 800-468-2646. Patrick Timpone. It is the Real World of Money. We're here every Wednesday, 9 to whenever we get done. And the archives are just loaded up with about, 500 and something Andrew Goss shows. You can burn them on CDs. You're allowed to do that free. And just put them in your car. And rather than listen to dumb talk shows like I do sometime, you can just get yourself a real education with Andrew Goss. Two books, Secret World of Money, and Uncle Sam Cooks the Books, and Andrew also loves sulfur.
In this country, the sulfur levels have been dropping. There was an alarm that went out to the Congress, and this was in 1932 or 34 when this big warning came out. Mineral quantities have been dropping in the U.S. for quite a while, and especially as farmland got worn out. Notable of things was the sulfur. And if you had been eating high sulfur foods all of your life, you may be getting enough sulfur, but we're not. And the sulfur content in foods is way low. And really, you need sulfur. The number one thing that sulfur does is it detoxifies the cells.
Thank you, George. George Altgeld on a previous show. He's a biologist, chemist, and knows a lot about agriculture. The number one thing, he says, is sulfur detoxifies the cells. This is pure sulfur. Very few of them are. Three prices, three locations, United States, Canada, and worldwide. Click an order, see the ad right-hand side on OneRadioNetwork.com. Previously, Dr. Richard Massey talks about colostrum.
When you get certain vaccines, you get leaky gut from it.
Mm-hmm.
Now remember, we're all born with leaky gut. Big holes in our gut, but there's no poop in there because we haven't been eating in the womb, right? And so nature's vaccination program is to get mama's colostrum, which has all the immune factors in it, right? Mm-hmm. So the gut is wide open. It's got leaks in it. So this colostrum can come through like an injection. When it does, the leaky gut closes.
So that's why the colostrum we take helps seal the gut.
It seals the leaky gut. But people who are vaccinated tend to have chronic leaky gut because the gut is waiting for the real thing. So people's guts are open like, hey, when is the real stuff coming in?
Can the cow stuff do it?
The cow stuff does it as well.
Oh, it does.
So you put those immune factors in with colostrum before eating meals. Mm-hmm. It goes in. It's nature's vaccination program. It closes the leaky gut. Then your autoimmune stuff goes down. Your food allergies go down. Wonderful stuff happens.
Thanks, Doc. We love this product. Colostrum, lots of different sizes to choose from. It's a great product. Click and order colostrum. Any of the SirThrival links, it's right here on OneRadioNetwork.com. SirThrival is Daniel Vitalis' company. We've been promoting them for, I think, 8 years now, and Daniel's been on the show many times. I met him several times. He's a really cool guy, just into high quality, just amazing, and they do a great job. And so if you're looking for some things, you want to invest a little money in your health, you know, you're into your health, you listen to this network, and you like to, you know, we invest a little money rather than just pulling out straight old vitamins, which are fine. But you might want to look at some of these products that SirThrival has. You know, the flagship there is the colostrum and the immune functions, and you can read all the stuff when you click on one of the links through One Radio Network. And then, of course, the pine pollen, which we love, and the elk velvet antler. Read about those products and how they're done, how they're made. Grape alcohol, organic, Myron glass. And then the shag and the reishi, which, you know, we all could take a little bit of that every day for the rest of our lives. And these tonic medicinal herbs can do nothing but good things for the body. And the medicinal herbs, mushrooms, rather, I think are going to be one of the big future new medicines in the next 10, 20 years. They're just now beginning to gain a lot of notoriety, medicinal mushrooms. But they're very powerful and been used in places around the world. Thousands of years, you know, just forever. So it's a great company, very clean products, very potent, well-crafted, and so we're really proud to be promoting Daniel Vitale. Any SirThrival link, and you can find it.
Know the source. One Radio Network. To talk to Patrick, call 888-663-6386 or email patrick@oneradionetwork.com. Once again, here's Patrick.
Where does the time go? How could it be 11 o'clock already? I don't understand it, you know?
Tempus fugit.
Time flies?
Yes, sir.
If you believe it. So, let's see. Bruce writes in SR93-549. Is that right?
That is correct.
Officially acknowledge the emergency created by FDR in 1933... wherein the people were declared enemies of the state in all their financial transactions. Really?
Well, more or less.
The government excluded the Trading with the Enemy Act, 1917, mods that FDR Congress instituted in 1933, PL 73-1. The emergency was then continued after 76.
Yes, by individual, like I said, about 30 executive orders after 1976.
But in this 33 thing, our S-549, were we really declared enemies of the state?
Well, effectively, yeah, in our financial transactions.
Oh, we were. I didn't mean to do anything. Sorry. You
became the enemy.
The reason Congress could not end the emergency, PL-73-1, was the fact that under international law, once the hostilities ceased, the property seized, the gold must be returned.
That's right.
Pretty difficult to return all the gold they stole under FDR's bogus declaration that the peeps were to be considered enemies of their own government, belligerents, therefore they, whatever, ends. Is that right? Must remain subject to military jurisdiction.
That's right.
Is this right?
That's right.
Doesn't sound good.
No, it's not good.
I don't understand it, but it doesn't sound
it's
good.
It's definitely not good.
It's not a good thing. That's pretty weird. They don't teach this in school, do they?
No, they don't. Yeah, it's not something you'll learn in school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which is more rare, coins minted at the Charlotte Mint or coins minted at the
Dahlonega?
Dahlonega. I love that one. Yeah. Dahlonega Mint, Jay in Asheville writes.
Yeah, I would. I mean, the Charlotte coins are pretty damn rare. They mm-hmm. are indeed. But boy, those Dahlonega coins. Every time I try to do a Dahlonega set, I'm always hung up.
Because it was just it wasn't a business that long.
No, it wasn't. Mm-hmm. And they were generally the poor stepchild of the minting system. So they got all the leftover equipment and, you know, leftover stuff. So generally the striking quality is poor. And there just aren't that many of them. So I would say between those two, both are very rare, but Dahlonega Mint is probably slightly rarer.
Plus, you kind of love the name, don't you, Dahlonega? Doesn't have
yeah, they have a raceway there as
have
well.
Have a nice kind of... And where is it located?
In Dahlonega, Georgia.
Dahlonega, Georgia. Well, let's see. Wasn't it just... the hacker thing on XP operating system?
Yeah.
Okay, that's what an email says there. Okay. Here you go.
Windows, though.
Windows.
Yeah, Microsoft Windows.
Well, I don't understand if a thing like this goes through the interweb, why, if you had a Mac, it wouldn't get to you. I don't get that.
Because it's written for a Windows.
Oh, it's written for the operating yeah. system. I see.
Right.
You should see there's the hugest Roadrunner sitting right outside my window on a Linda. Have you ever seen one of these things?
Yeah, I have a 70
so
Roadrunner.
Big. No, not that kind. This is a real one. Man, he's beautiful. Big red head. I mean, he is a large bird. Wow.
See any wily coyotes hanging around?
Well... beep beep. Nyow. Have you ever seen them run too? They are just hilarious. They really, wow, what's he doing out there? Is that a sign of something?
I don't know.
Could it be
couldn't
a sign?
I don't do signs.
You don't do signs? Okay. I'm going to have to look that up. What does a Roadrunner mean? Andy always says that the U.S. is about 95% of transactions are electronic, writes Joseph. What he always forgets to mention is that in countries like Germany, Austria, about 80 to 85% is done in cash, maybe because they experienced fascism firsthand.
That's right.
Is that true?
That is true, yeah. Yep.
You mean like in those kind of places?
They don't trust electronic money as much as we do.
I'll be darned.
You know, they've had their money taken countless times.
Mm-hmm.
So generationally, they tend to not trust electronic money any more than they trusted paper money. But the fact that they trust paper is surprising to me.
So Gloria wants to understand. I don't understand how the blockchain, which seems to be the new thing with digital, is going to allow the boys to steal more from us.
Well, because blockchain will give them a cheaper way to transfer money faster. And they're not going to pass the savings on to you.
Huh. Oh, okay. This article here says central governments around the globe have waged against their own citizens a virtual war on cash efforts by Sweden to become cash-free, progressive downsizing of Eurozone currency units, currency recall in India that affected 13 billion people. So they say the foundation here is the blockchain. The blockchain there. This is the whole Bitcoin idea where this is all going, right?
That's right.
And then how is gold going to be involved in this now?
It's not.
Oh, it's not.
No.
But they're going to do a blockchain gold thing, right? Like we talked
yes.
about. Yeah.
Yeah. Just so that you uniquely identify the gold that belongs to you with a blockchain.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Looks like some big pension funds are going to lose a lot of money in this Puerto Rico deal.
No doubt.
Wow, man.
Which means that the pensioners are going to use a lot of money.
Yeah. Meanwhile, six other funds managed by Vanguard, Goldman, Western Asset, Lord Albertson, have up to between $100 million and $200 million in losses from the Puerto Rico deal. So that gets passed right on to the people who have funds in Vanguard. Right?
That's true, yeah.
Oops. They didn't tell you that in the fine print, did they? How do they know that Puerto Rico goes belly up and I lose money?
Yeah, well, if you have bonds in Puerto Rico within your fund, yeah, you lose money.
And do people generally know what bonds are? They don't know, do they?
They don't read the prospectus.
Yeah.
The prospectus, rather, excuse me. I mean, who reads the prospectus? You get this big, heavy, you know, very thin paper book in the mail. Are you going to read every
Nobody
page?
Nobody reads that.
Nobody does, yeah.
So, and Vanguard and these people were into Puerto Rican bonds because they're paying a high interest rate because they're so risky.
That's right.
And that's how it works, right?
Yeah. High interest rate and tax-free treatment.
Oh, tax-free. So how does, why, because all these munis are tax-free, right?
That's right.
This is a USG thing, creation.
Well, it's tax-free triple, no matter, you know, which state you live in or anything like that. The tax treatment is going to be the same.
Free. And they do this so people will lend money so the cities can borrow more money.
Yeah, so people will buy their bonds. Yeah.
Otherwise, people wouldn't buy their bonds?
Yeah, why would you? Unless you were getting some special incentive. And that tax-free treatment is pretty special depending on your tax bracket.
Mm-hmm. Home sales jumped. The Wall Street Journal. Of course, it's not fake news. But anyway, home sales jumped to near boom level area levels. Home sales in the first quarters hit their fastest pace in a decade. The sign that rising prices and slightly higher mortgage rates haven't deterred home buyers from rushing into the market. So this thing's still driving forward, right? What's the general 30-year thing going for now?
It's still under 5%.
Is it? Yeah. And that's, you still like that as free money?
That is free money, is 5%. Free money. Yeah. I mean, the inflation rate is greater than that. Mm-hmm. And when you consider the tax treatment of paying interest, right, it's all deductible. So you're either gonna have a mortgage on your house, or you're gonna pay a lot of taxes. One or the other.
Mm-hmm. Question: could Andrew say which are the most important globalist New World Order places to visit in London, apart from the obvious ones like the Palace, the Bank of England, the Pilgrim Society, the RIIA? He looks like he's got them. N.M. Rothschild, Tavistock, LSE, Marx's grave. There's something about Hammer Stoutly in London that Sandy's mentioned in the past.
Right.
So I think this fellow's going to go for a trip. Yeah, good.
Okay, so write this. The Beatrice Webb House.
The Beatrice Webb House.
W-E-B-B, Beatrice Webb.
Yeah.
This is thanks to John Prenderville of Las Vegas, who graciously actually put eyes on this thing when I was writing The Secret World of Money. And in the Beatrice Webb House, which was the headquarters of the Fabian Society?
Yeah,
Fabian Socialists.
No relation to Fabian of 1963. Rock and roll fame.
Okay. No, but they have a window, a stained glass window that has pictures of all the boys in various outfits. And the motto there is hammer stoutly and pray devoutly. Yes.
That's a great one. We like that.
Yeah, so I would add that to your list of must-see.
Does Andy know of any, same email here, satanic sculptures we might can encounter in jolly old Albion, where the city of London might one find the city's incorporation papers? Well, this guy's it, man. He's into this stuff.
Yeah, he is, yeah. And I can't help
it's
him with
either
of those.
Going on a Da Vinci Code trip here.
Yeah, right. But the city's incorporation papers would be interesting. Mm-hmm. Basically, showing this, you know, district that is super extra jurisdictional. Like no one has jurisdiction in the city of London.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly not the Queen. So it's much like the city of New York sets out this area and the District of Columbia and the Vatican, where there is no law except the law that they say.
Joe sounds like he's going on a scavenger hunt here. He's going to have a good time. For that matter, by why I'm thinking about it, he says, where's the repository that holds DC's incorporation papers that Andy sometimes refers to as the plastic on the couch? Would there be such documentation regarding admiralty law, the flag of the U.S. Incorporated, the other such goodies that some researcher might want to dig up?
Well, what you want to dig up is the Erie versus Tompkins case, which occurred after this national emergency declaration in 1933. I believe Erie versus Tompkins was 1934, and it's commonly referred to as the merger of law and equity, where the common law was essentially abolished, and we were put on a system of and Lex Mercantoria Merchant Law, or the Uniform Commercial Code.
What's the difference?
Well, it's all the same. It's merchant law. It's commercial law. It's not constitutional law, or, you know, has nothing to do with constitutional rights or the Constitution. It has nothing to do with common law, exactly. It's admiralty law or merchant law.
Well, what would be a difference? Give us an example.
Well, a difference would be there's no right to free speech. There's no guaranteed right to property. There's no, and none of the things that we take for granted.
That's a big difference.
Yeah, it's
so
a huge
how did
difference.
They morph from constitutional to admiralty because of this
state of emergency?
The state of emergency.
Right, and then the following year, this Erie versus Tompkins case came to be.
And that was about what?
I couldn't even tell you.
Okay. But anyway, so what did that establish, that admiralty law was okay?
It has simply established that there is no common law, but there is a uniform commercial code. It was effectively the merger of law and equity, according to Eustace Mullen's book, The Rape of Justice. So it essentially abolished the common law and put us all under admiralty law or merchant law, which has fewer rights and is more concerned about transactions than human rights.
Universal Commercial Code, UCC.
UCC.
Yeah, and people do UCC filings.
Yes, they
What does
do.
That mean? So what is a UCC? Did you ever do a UCC filing?
Oh, sure.
What is it?
So it is when someone owes you money.
Yeah.
And they pledge their certain assets to you for loaning them money, then you file a UCC-1 statement with your county clerk that says, hey, Joe owes me money and his property is pledged against that loan. So that if Joe tries to borrow money again using that, well, then there's notice that it's already lient.
I see. Okay.
But what most people I've seen do is if they themselves have a large asset, then they put a lien on themselves. That's what this UCC filing is all about. It is also where you would file to put them on notice that you are not a part of the UCC. So that's what the UCC-1 filing is. Typically, it is a bank filing against property that you own under the Uniform Commercial Code for purposes of letting everyone else know that they have a lien on this property.
Oh. It's kind of tricky.
Well, it is tricky.
Kind of tricky stuff.
You know, so is commercial law.
So common law says a lot of cool things. It came from England, right?
No, it came from our accumulation of law. And, you know, the common law was originally the Ten Commandments. It was, you know, things that we can all agree on. Do all you have agreed to do. Right.
And just don't encroach on other person's or their
that's
property.
Right. That's, yeah, kind, so of that's
the,
kind of
the Richard Mayberry 17 words, right?
Yeah.
The two laws.
And then, you know, the Constitution gives us laws that are common to all the states and individual to the people. So that's part of the common law. Commercial law is something entirely different.
Now, there's a big deal here in Texas now because Governor Abbott is saying that you guys that are doing these sanctuary cities in Texas, forget it, because they're just, you know, you're breaking the law. You know, you got to do it and we're going to come and get you, kind of thing. So there's a big fight here.
Well, Governor Abbott has that power. See, that's within states' rights. That's clearly the jurisdiction of the state of Texas, a municipality in Texas. It's going to be hard to make the argument that they have no jurisdiction.
Oh, so Governor Abbott probably has jurisdiction.
You bet he does. Now, the federal government making the same edict might have problems because they don't have jurisdiction technically, and they could be challenged.
Mm-hmm.
But the governor of Texas, not much doubt.
So there's going to be a lot of this going on then with the medical marijuana and all of that, where the feds are still not happy with, you know, because of, you know, who knows why.
Yeah, but they know that they couldn't withstand a jurisdictional challenge. So they don't, you know, they won't enforce.
Oh, because they know they would lose.
That's right. Anyone, you know, this is advice one. if you're finding yourself in a legal entanglement with any government agency, first thing you should do is question their jurisdiction over both you and the subject matter. So they have to have jurisdiction over both before they can proceed. And the rule at law is jurisdiction, once challenged, must be proven. But if it's not challenged, it's assumed to exist.
So I remember I did a course with Dr. Rivera, not Rivera, but Rivera, on jurisdiction and the four organic laws years ago, right? It was
sure.
A year-long course, and he kind of makes a pretty great case that I don't really live in the United States, right? And
blah, oh, no.
Blah, blah, blah. I live in
Texas.
I live in Texas, and they don't have any jurisdiction. But then the last 2 years, you kind of taught me that, well, that might be true.
But the judges will take silent judicial notice.
But I'm
because
on the plastic.
That's right, because when you get to court for
which
that
Rivera doesn't go into when he does his court.
No, I guess not.
He leaves that off.
When you get to court and the jurisdictional hearing occurs, and the prosecutor says to you, Patrick, do you have a bank account? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a social security number? Yes. Mm-hmm. Do you have a driver's license?
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I rest my case. And then the judge takes silent judicial notice that all three of those things put you on the plastic.
Okay, I got you. But I thought you just said that if you challenge your jurisdiction, they'd have to prove it, but they can't prove it. Oh, they can?
Well, in that case, they just did.
Oh, just because you're on the plastic.
Correct.
Even though
all the prosecutor did was prove that you were on the plastic.
I see. That's all they have to do?
That's it. And then the judge says, okay.
Whatever. Move along here.
Move along. They have jurisdiction.
Wow.
Doesn't have to point to which thing the prosecutor said convinced him that they have jurisdiction. Remember, there's no jury. This is a jurisdictional hearing, so there's no jury.
Makes sense to me.
So the judge takes silent judicial notice that you have, in fact, a bank account. And on every card, signature card for a bank account, there's a box that says, are you a U.S. citizen? Yes or no? And, you know, if you have a bank account, you had to sign a signature card. So him asking you, do you have a bank account? Yes. That's it. That's all they need to know.
And then if you're a U.S. citizen, then the game changes because then you're on the plastic.
And clearly you're in their jurisdiction.
Oh, just because you're a citizen.
Of course, if you weren't a citizen, they would have no jurisdiction over you.
Hmm. Oh, okay. Well, it makes sense to me. So, man, what a curious thing this all is. It's just so much fun, isn't it, to try to figure this stuff out?
Yeah, and once you have it figured out, then you just act accordingly.
Yeah, then you just know, play within the, you know, within the rules.
That's my belief, yes.
Yeah. Why would you not? Because then it'd just be an uphill battle.
Right.
That's not good. I've been reading a little bit about these Tesla solar tempered glass roof tiles, and I did some of the math, and without the federal tax credit,
it's worthless.
This thing doesn't work.
That's right.
Does it?
No.
So Tesla, you know, Elon is getting a...
Oh, huge subsidy.
He's getting a subsidy.
Huge subsidy.
So why...
Without federal subsidies, there would be no electric cars. There would be no solar panels. There would be nothing. No, and there's no way they could produce it cheaper. It's only with the subsidies that it becomes cheaper.
But the USG doesn't give a flip about alternative energy. They like coal and whatever.
Well, yeah.
Right? So why do they do this? Just whatever makes them look good.
I'm sure there's some payola along the way.
Really?
Yeah, unfortunately.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, you could do the square footage thing, and I kind of tied it in with mine and what we paid 20 years ago per square foot. And even with the subsidy, that's a lot more expensive than what I paid it with these solar tiles. More per square foot. So, and the payout is very long.
Yeah, the amount of time that it takes
very
to get your money
long.
Back.
So
yeah.
People would generally do this more, I guess, like I was doing it 20 years ago for philosophical reasons, right?
It'd right.
Be great to do it because that'd be fun to be off the grid and
right.
not to depend on anybody. But electricity is still a lot cheaper than solar.
Yeah. And I hate to say it, but the cheapest electricity of all is that which powered is nuclear power. It's the least expensive.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. So if you built a new place from scratch, Andrew Goss, knowing what you know about solar, would you do the Tesla thing or solar, or would you just go ahead and take the electricity?
Oh, no, I would do the combinations of all of them.
Would you?
I would indeed, yeah. Yep.
It's just so you kind of have covered.
That's right. I mean, you have to put a roof on your house.
Yeah, you might as well put a tempered glass roof.
That's right. If you don't have to rip off the old roof and then put a new roof, if you could just start and offset some of the roof cost, well, then, again, planning from the beginning and building a house,
might as well
incorporating.
Get some space. And also, as a rainwater collection guy, which I am, it'd be pretty fun to have a tempered glass roof. That'd be a nice surface.
Good for your water, yeah.
Oh, yeah, it'd be a good surface. You know, it'd be a good surface, probably better than Galvalume, which I have now, or whatever they use. Probably less goobies in there with tempered glass. Unless they put some really toxic stuff on there, so you'd have to be careful about that. But that's pretty interesting. That's pretty cool. You would think that Elon, with everything that they've done and engineering-wise, would be able to figure this whole battery thing out more than what they've done. Do you think there's you understand this stuff, Andrew. Do you think there's a real, just a black hole as far as storing this energy in a more affordable way? Why haven't they been able to figure out it? If there was something there, wouldn't they have already found it?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
No.
Why?
Because they've just started looking. The first real push in batteries technology.
Just 25 years, right?
Yeah. We haven't been at it very long.
Right.
Storing electricity is a relatively new phenomenon. Mm-hmm. So, and the battery that they have in the Cairo Museum, the Baghdad battery.
I don't know that one.
Oh, yeah. You have your Google that up.
Baghdad battery.
The Baghdad battery that's in the Cairo Museum, basically the technology for a wet cell battery that we use today is exactly the same.
Huh.
So it's like, in 2,000, 5,000 years, we haven't changed a thing in terms of battery technology. So the point is, they've just started to experiment with different metals and different minerals and different materials, and I predict battery technology and energy storage will grow by leaps and bounds as we move forward.
Yeah.
So,
and then they keep working on the amount of juice that you can get on a square foot of what material, and if you can store it in a battery cheaper that's not so heavy, you could actually see how they could have this stuff on roofs of cars. That's what I think would be cool.
Sure.
And you're driving around, and you're just juicing up, you're gassing up while you're driving.
That's right.
Man, now you're talking, right?
And especially if you're embracing the best technology in terms of battery storage, yes.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Of course, then you wouldn't want to drive around in Oregon and Washington because the sun never comes out there, and then your car wouldn't work.
Well, that is the drawback of solar power, isn't it?
That's a problem. Yeah. Well, gold is just, what's going on? $20 up this morning. Is this all just chaos?
Yeah.
Chaos?
Gotcha.
Like geopolitical chaos?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Washington's
Trump,
got their,
a Trump quake.
A Trump quake.
Yeah, everyone is panicking. Boy, if he loses, his agenda loses. There go the tax cuts. There go all the reasons for growth.
Uh-huh.
Dollar is doomed. The whole nine yards.
Well, I forgot to ask you, Mr. Trump is off to Saudi Arabia tomorrow. What do you think the kind of conversation he's going to have with that guy with his little funny hat on?
Investing in U.S. infrastructure.
Oh, really? Oh, you mean all the money that we give you guys for oil? But they already, don't they, Andrew? They buy a lot of treasury
notes they do.
Already, right?
But being able to invest in a bridge or a road will get them a better rate of return while allowing them to own tangible property. So I'm sure the big focus of what he's doing is going to be on that.
And also, I think he's going to start pounding his chest and saying Iraq is really getting stable and all that. They took Mosul and, look what we've done and this is great. And, even though he said he was against the war, I'm sure he's going to be talking about what a great job they did,
Yeah, that was before he was for the war.
That was before the war, yeah. Before the war.
He was against the war, but that was before.
I know, that was before.
Yeah.
Well, politicians or non-politicians learn quickly how to be politicians in that place.
They do,
that White House, you know.
Yes, they do.
Mr. Goss, it's always a pleasure, sir. Give your phone number out there if somebody would like to reach you.
If you'd like to talk to me, call 1-800-468-2646.
800-468-2646. Andrew Sirt, take care. Say hi to everybody. We'll see you real soon.
I will. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Andrew Goss, Patrick Timpone, and the Real World of Money. Pass this on to everyone that you care about. We will see you tomorrow. We're going to do a little thing on dark field microscopy and of the blood, and it's really cool. And also, we're going to get an update from a good friend and really a brave, brave girl who's gone from stage 4 breast cancer to practically nothing at all without doing, well, doing all natural things and just not doing the contemporary medicine approach, which is pretty brave and cool. Her name is Jana Perry. She'll be here tomorrow. Thanks to Sharon and all her work and Lynn taking notes. We'll see you tomorrow, 9 o'clock, OneRadioNetwork.com.
Broadcasting from the beautiful Hill Country in Texas, this is OneRadioNetwork.com.